John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. On this week's show, we'll be talking about episode 10 of our series on the conviction of Dennis Perry, Mafia, which attempted to make sense of the multiple threads that wove the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain to the Dixie Mafia and Donnie Barentine. And with us today are Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hey there, Colin Miller.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm good. You're bracing yourself for the hurricane that is fast approaching?
Yeah, we're preparing here. The school has been closed the last couple of days, and we're just hoping for the best.
Yes. Well, please be careful and take care of yourself. And listen to the authorities, Colin. I know you're a rebel, and you're all about not paying attention to the man. But this time, listen to the man if he says leave. Okay, that's my little bit of advice for the day. But also joining us is Celeste Trusty. You may remember her. She visited us during the Chester Holman series. She's an advocate for the wrongfully convicted out of Philadelphia. And she has recently joined the team at FAM, which is a state family organization helping families with loved ones serving mandatory minimum sentences share their stories. Oh, and fun fact, she was also born 5 days after Beyonce. Which I think everything she says now should be colored with that understanding. That
100% agree with that.
But thank you for coming back. And when you were on the last time, we talked about many of the inmates that you've gotten close to over the years, whose cases you've been working on. And I was curious, how are they doing? You mentioned several of them.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are doing really, really well, which is great. The prison lockdown in Pennsylvania was recently lifted, so I know a lot of them are happy about that. I was recently out in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, visiting my friend Ralph Stokes, who's been on death row for basically since I was in diapers. And I believe in his innocence, and he's been proclaiming his innocence the whole time. But I got to spend the whole day with him, which was really, really nice. He spends most of his time, I think, 23 hours or 20 to 23 hours a day in a cell alone. So it's really good to be able to go up there and visit. I brought another friend who's another advocate up to visit a friend, Terry Williams, who was on death row for 32 years and then was recently resentenced to life without parole. So he's now able to have contact visits and visits in general population. And he recently has lost over 70 pounds since moving off the row, which I'm so proud of him for. He's doing it right. He's exercising a lot and eating well. So it's really good to see that happen. So not that they'll hear this, but hey, guys, and I love you.
So when they're on death row, they don't have any kind of privileges towards the outside world in terms of they have no access to computers or anything like that. Is that correct?
So yes and no. So they actually do have access to tablets if they purchase a tablet or there's a tablet kiosk that they can email. So in Pennsylvania, they do have access to email, which is really, really nice. So that it's quick, it's nice, because a lot of times snail mail does take very long, and it's a very different process. So it's nice and it's quick for them, but there's no computers and there's also no contact visits, which makes it a little bit difficult.
I would imagine. Now, actually, Colin pointed out something to me that on Twitter the other day, you had tweeted a story about police in New Jersey fanning out in overnight raids to capture parents who are in contempt of court. And you mentioned that had a personal connection for you. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this really awesome journalist in Philadelphia, Samantha Melamed, she, if you don't follow her on Twitter, you really should. She produces some really amazing work about the criminal justice system in Pennsylvania. And she released a really great story about how they will go around and round up parents who are delinquent on their child support and put them in jail. And, you know, this criminalization of poverty really did affect me as a child. You know, unfortunately, my father was often behind on his child support obligations. And multiple times throughout my life, my father was actually rounded up right before Father's Day and taken to jail on about a 30-day hold because he was late on his child support. And in this situation, you know, the system really decided what was more beneficial. And they thought that it was more beneficial to shame my father, you know, and put him in jail as opposed to letting him be with his children on Father's Day. And, you know, that is not what justice is. And it's certainly not something I can accept as justice. You know, it's unfortunate because it wasn't even my mother initiating this process. It was the system. It wasn't the family unit initiating this process. And, you know, it causes irreparable harm to these relationships, these family relationships. And, you know, my dad missed out on so many different events and things, his sister's funeral and things like that, because of being late on child support. And it really, this whole program and idea is such, it's such a testament to what our justice system really thinks is important. And that's shaming people and being punitive as opposed to looking at the situation. You know, my father is a Vietnam vet. He has struggled his whole entire life with a lot of different things, trying to just stay afloat, trying to, having 2 and 3 jobs at a time. He wasn't a deadbeat. He was struggling. And so instead of putting him in jail and putting him in a situation where he would most likely be losing the income that he had, it seems like there's a much better way of handling these family situations that won't necessarily break the bonds that we know are so important when kids are growing up.
Yeah, I understand when things are initiated by families, you know, when somebody says, you know, look, he's been making money, but he has not been doing this. But how is it triggered by the state without the family? That's confusing to me.
Well, I mean, Pennsylvania, you go through domestic relations a lot of times for child support. The wages are garnished through child support. And then if you don't have income, you are in arrears. And so they find out who is delinquent and they decide to round them up. They would usually, I believe, warn my mother to let them know that they were going to be doing this, but it wasn't ever her initiating the process. And most of the time she just, you know, she was upset. But as a child, you know, you're looking at the fact that your father is in jail on Father's Day. And instead of looking at it like, okay, well, the system, you know, is broken, or actually not broken. It was made to be this way, to criminalize the people who who society feels need to stay criminalized. But it just seems like the way that they did this, there's no way of repairing the damage that they're doing. And I'm glad that Samantha wrote a piece on this, because I think that this is a program that not enough people know about. And I think that if people were more exposed to it, maybe there could be more programs and more services put in place for fathers and other parents who are delinquent. So instead of being put in jail and everything that goes with that, they're able to, you know, to get help through some sort of social program.
That's astonishing to me to hear, by the way, because my father struggled paying child support as well. When I was a kid, my father was an actor, and, you know, it's a gig economy, and there's years where he did fine, and then there was years that were terrible. And my mom was in the arts as well, so she understood it, and there was no rancor between the two of them. She understood that when he, you know, that he was trying. And that amazes me, the huge difference in my experience of that than something that, like, what happened to you is just so, so disturbing to me. I'm so sorry that that you guys had to go through that.
Well, thank you. But you know what? Those experiences really helped build who I am as a justice reform advocate. If I didn't go through that, if my father wasn't treated that way as a Black man, a poor man in America, I might not be who I am, and I might not be in the line of work that I am in. So it was unfortunate, but my dad is awesome, and we have a great relationship now. And so it is, you know, it is unfortunate, but it's definitely something that helped me internalize the struggle of others in the situation.
I also wanted to bring up, you're in the midst of Philadelphia's criminal justice system, which is undergoing a pretty big sea change right now with Larry Krasner as the district attorney. My understanding was that he recently hired 38 new prosecutors, because remember, when he came in, he swept out a bunch of the old prosecutors, and that obviously left a lot of people who were not happy in that situation, understandably to some degree. But he has hired 38 new prosecutors, most of whom are apparently recent law graduates. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I applaud him for this. I mean, I know a lot of people are upset about it. You know, I think it's important to clean house. You know, Philadelphia has a really, really iffy history with justice reform and criminal justice in general. And it's important to get people out who are stuck in the ideals of the old administration, people who are against what, you know, the new policies and who are unwilling to participate in new policies. I think it is a really great move. Of course, there are going to be people who disagree. And of course, there are going to be people who think that he's doing the wrong thing and hiring inexperienced prosecutors. But these prosecutors who recently graduated from law school, they've been taught with the newest, you know, techniques. of social justice, and they've been trained, they've been screened. And so I'm really, really excited to see what comes of this. I'm really excited. I was out getting coffee last weekend and I saw Larry Krasner go in and get coffee. I didn't bother him because he looked like he wanted to be left alone with a, a hat hanging out. But, I was really, really impressed. I sat there and thought, I have been looking at district attorneys in Philadelphia for so long. And the fact that I was sitting in a coffee shop and the district attorney of Philadelphia just decided to go get a coffee by himself on a Saturday morning, without guards, and I didn't want to get up and yell at him. It was a really refreshing feeling, as someone who I grew up and I've been born and raised in the Philadelphia area my whole life. So I love this city. And so to, be up against administrations before Krasner and seeing the justice reform process be so slow, it's been extremely refreshing and awesome to see what Krasner's been doing. And I can't wait to see what else he has coming up.
And Colin, I imagine you're the one with the most experience of the newer generation of law school graduates. How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting decision by Krasner. And to Celeste's point, it makes a lot of sense to say, look, these are people who are new grads. They've just learned about professional responsibility from law school. They're going to come in and they're not going to be tainted by these years of corruption here in Philadelphia. On the other hand, I understand the concern to say these are wet behind the ears attorneys who don't have a lot of experience. And so, I expect there are going to be some growing pains there, but I sort of love the idea that Krasner is bringing in this fresh blood and these people who are brand new attorneys, and they're able to bring an entirely new perspective to something that has been so problematic and troublesome for so many years in Philadelphia.
Yes, I imagine they'll have to reassess every case from the jump, because they're going to have to reassess every part of it, looking with new eyes. I think that can probably be very valuable.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it fits with Krasner's idea of completely reformulating the idea of what a district attorney's office is. I mean, this is something I would say is unprecedented across the country to have this vision of what a DA's office is. And you can see it across all the policies they've enacted. And so to have these brand new attorneys come in, and this is their first experience in the legal field beyond what they did as law students, it's fascinating. And, I just hope that people in the media and in the legal community there in Philadelphia allow for some growing pains. There are going to be some growing pains, but I think that the payoff in the long run could be tremendous.
The most important time is now. The importance of feeling professional, polished, and prepared when it counts right now. For small business owners or people who produce their own podcasts, being plugged in and prepared when an opportunity comes up is crucial. Those moments happen all the time. They're happening now. And having a business card that shows how professional you are in your pocket, ready to hand out, is the first step to making something happen. Your next big opportunity is coming right now. And all it takes to feel like you're ready to own the now is $10. That's a low price to have the confidence that you're always ready to make an impression or get seen in a new way. A custom card with the colors, fonts, designs, and images that you choose means you can look and feel like a big deal, whether you're a startup or a business with a century of history. And it doesn't have to be hard. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. Simply upload your own design or start with one of their professionally designed options. Vistaprint offers simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. Then, pick the paper stock, style, and quantity that is right for you. Choose your delivery speed, order, and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. They have dozens of designs that are just right for your business. Simply add your logo and contact information with just a few clicks, and know you can use it on all of your marketing going forward. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or ordering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to do something great for your business right now, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Use the code UNDISCLOSED at Vistaprint.com. That's code UNDISCLOSED at Vistaprint.com. UNDISCLOSED at Vistaprint.com.
Now, I wanted to get to this week's episode of Undisclosed, which went into a lot of back and forth in terms of what Jeff Cottrell claimed and what Donnie Barentine claimed and how the Dixie Mafia operates to some extent. But it sort of nibbled at the periphery a little bit. I didn't understand, like, to me, something that wasn't clear, and Celeste, you can chime in on this as well. For some reason, everybody decided Greg Barentine had this huge amount of power. Like when he said you did something, you just did it. I don't know that we have gotten into that. Is there any explanation for why that was?
I mean, we don't have that much information in it, but it does seem that everyone sort of respected and almost feared Greg, and he was seen as someone who commanded a lot of authority. I don't know that it was anything official in terms of the Dixie Mafia or the position that he held, but it was certainly something where everyone gave a great deal of deference to Greg.
And there was something that was not clear to me, because Greg Barentine's ex-wife claims that he changed after their daughter was killed. Meanwhile, Roberson says that Greg Barentine's son was killed. So I'm confused. Did he lose two children?
Yeah, I had the same question. I didn't know if I just misheard that or not. I mean, it would make sense if he already did have a powerful reputation that after his son was killed by Roberson, that he would have even more power over him. But yeah, did he have two children that were killed?
That's a good question. I'm not 100% sure. Susan probably has more inside info on that than I do. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure whether he had one or two children.
Yeah, and I have to say, it was a big red flag to me, the incident that his son, I guess it was Little John or Little Joe, I don't remember exactly what, and that incident seemed somewhat suspicious to me, that Roberson was claiming it was an accidental shooting, but, you know, we're dealing with people who seem to be involved in criminal enterprises. I feel like there's more to that story.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a bit reflected in the episode where we said the circumstances aren't entirely clear. It's not certain what happened. I mean, you think from the reporting that it was just they were playing around with a gun that went off. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly credible to believe that there was something else going on there.
Okay, so Donnie is still alive, right? Donnie Barentine is still alive?
Yes.
Got it. And Greg Barentine, is he still alive?
Greg, as far as I know, is still alive.
Got it. Jeff Cottrell has passed. He's dead.
Yes. Correct. Yes, he is no longer with us. Yes.
Okay. I'm just checking up on everybody and doing a head count at this point because they're dropping like flies. And one of the investigators at one point claimed that the Barentine brothers walked from a drug conviction. Was that with that same prosecutor who died later?
That's my understanding, right? It was the same prosecutor in both cases.
So I believe that was Glenn Thompson?
Right.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm going to pepper you with a bunch of questions and just feel free to say, I'm sorry, I don't know that, because it's a lot of minutia. Because was that the same prosecutor who let off Jeff Cottrell? Because he seemed like he was really trying to minimize Jeff Cottrell's bad behavior when he was making that speech.
Yeah, I believe it's the same prosecutor in all these cases. And as you say, it does certainly seem that he is trying to minimize the role there. And it's not entirely clear how all these different pieces fit together, but yeah, there's some question marks there raised to these various different incidents.
So it really seems to hint that deals were being made to get people either as witnesses or to give up information. It sounds like that may have made it difficult for them to continue prosecuting the crime.
Right, because all these collateral cases, we have all these sort of secondary deals dealing with conspiracy or drug charges. And then that complicates matters when you're trying to prosecute this murder. And people who are giving deals related to these other crimes now are having relevant information related to this murder of the Swains.
I also wanted to get to the polygraph test that Donnie Barentine. I mean, there was a couple of big bombshells in this. There was the polygraph test that Donnie took, as well as the supposed prison confession, which we'll get to later. But it fascinated me that everybody took a different meaning, put a different meaning on the way that the polygraph test went. I mean, we know he took a polygraph test and for what it's worth, it failed, or he failed it rather. But it's fascinating that the investigator decided, oh, well, you know, he took the fact that he wanted to take one to mean that he probably was not guilty. But obviously, Susan was looking for it as the opportunity to get one more interview that could have elucidated some of the facts in the thing. Colin, we've talked about polygraphs in the past. Do you feel like they serve any kind of legitimate use anymore?
Yeah, well, that's why I find Susan's point to be interesting, because there's a whole body of law around polygraphs. And of course, we know the standard company line, which is the polygraph evidence is inadmissible. But what happens are two things. So first, when a person takes an actual polygraph and fails, they often thereafter make incriminatory statements. They confess to the crime because they failed the polygraph. That statement is fully admissible even if the failed polygraph is not. The second is that oftentimes you'll have officers doing fake polygraph tests and telling a suspect that they failed, or they give them a legitimate polygraph test and they lie and they say that they failed. And of course, police, as we've said in the podcast, are able to lie. And so oftentimes either those fake tests or fake results lead to confessions that people then can have used against them at trial. In terms of the statement by Bundy and the willingness to take a polygraph test, that is a sort of split among jurisdictions. Some say a person's willingness to take a polygraph test can be used to show that they're innocent, they have consciousness of innocence. Other jurisdictions say it's completely worthless to have that. So I think that's interesting to see that related law and how it relates to what Susan and Bundy were thinking. In terms of polygraphs themselves, I mean, I think that they show what they're intended to test, which is a person's stress level. And if a person is failing a polygraph, that means that in response to questioning, they're having a certain stress response in terms of their sweat, their skin, et cetera. And that can be useful, certainly, in terms of pursuing them as a suspect. In terms of independently proving guilt or innocence, I don't think it has much worth.
Yeah, I think that one of the things, I mean, Barantine, however you say his name, you know, he says, oh, he felt, you know, he's always nervous. He's always been a little bit nervous. But I know that when polygraphers give tests, they give a baseline couple questions, like what is your name, to kind of test your stress response. And so I certainly don't buy the nervousness as a reasoning for why he actually failed that polygraph test. But what I find interesting about this polygraph is it doesn't seem like there's an existing record of what he was asked when and his actual responses to the questions. And that is concerning to me, because if there's an existing record of the polygraph that he failed, okay, he failed it. I really want to know what he was asked and what his answers were, because I think that that would really be helpful to find out what questions he was asked and what his stress response was to those questions.
Yeah, I feel like it's useful as a tactic, but useless as evidence.
Exactly, right.
And I can see why police officers want to have as many tactics at their disposal. That lying and saying that you failed when you didn't, I realize, is just a total mind F. that would, and I'm sure the argument is, okay, you've just mind F'd somebody. Can you then rely on what they say after that? Is that the argument, Colin?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we have the Supreme Court precedent that says that police officers can lie and can use deception unless it basically overwhelms the will of the suspect and makes it such that their confession or statement is involuntary. And to your point, John, I would agree with you in the sense that if I am a suspect, I've been charged with a crime, I'm at the police station, I take a polygraph or something I think is a polygraph, and I'm told, you failed the polygraph, you're lying, you committed this crime, whether it be a murder, an arson, et cetera, I'm going to try immediately to minimize my responsibility and, you know, probably falsely confess and make it seem as if I had as little culpability as possible. Now, maybe I hold out, maybe I can say the test is wrong. I know enough as a law professor to say that polygraph evidence is inadmissible, but you take someone who is a typical defendant who is indigent, oftentimes young and uneducated, and they're being told, you've been charged with a serious crime, you just failed a polygraph test. You can easily see how that person would have their will overwhelmed and make inculpatory statements.
Celeste, I was curious, with the inmates that you've worked with who you have real questions about their cases, has that been something that they've dealt with a lot?
Honestly, I haven't seen a ton of polygraph utilized in these cases, because the goal isn't necessarily to get to the truth. You know, if you're using a polygraph as an investigative tool to try to find out, you know, who did what and try to find, you know, the truth of a crime, doing that to somebody who's actually innocent is certainly not going to help with your narrative. And a lot of times in wrongful convictions, the police involved and the prosecutor involved aren't necessarily looking to find the real offender. They're trying to just fit their case and fit what they're saying is going to lead to a conviction of the person that they have in custody and that they've charged. So I think a lot of times in the cases that I'm looking at, a polygraph might make a case fall apart. And so that could be why I haven't seen polygraphs used in a lot of the cases that I'm looking at. A lot of the cases that I look at are from a single prosecutor or a couple different prosecutors in a specific era in Philadelphia. And so that also could be because maybe they didn't use polygraph quite as much then. And they used other investigative tactics to try to get confessions out of people that might not have been polygraphed.
Colin, I wanted to get to the Barentine's party confession because it was corroborated by several other people who were at the party. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have several people speaking to this confession.
Got it. And was that before the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired?
That was. Yeah, that's my understanding, is that that confession was before Unsolved Mysteries.
Got it. So that would tend to lend credence to that one. And in that one, that was, at least according to Jeff Cottrell, he remembers that Donnie spoke of having a blonde accomplice. That's correct, right?
Right. A blonde accomplice who had wire rimmed glasses. And yes, now I think it definitely would be before Unsolved Mysteries because the questions there were related to, well, what was in the media at the time of this confession? And so, yeah, it was before Unsolved Mysteries.
But then Timmy Walker and Sue Wilkes, now they weren't at that party, correct? So they weren't contradicting Jeff's recollection of that. They were just saying that at one point he was saying later that Donnie's... I'm sorry. Okay. This episode was a little bit frustrating because I was trying to keep the different threads correct. So Timmy Walker was saying that Donnie actually confessed to the actual shooting without an accomplice. Is that right?
Right. Timmy Walker and Sue Wilkes say that Barentine's confession does not reference a blonde man. Whereas Jeff Cottrell is saying he is giving this confession. He's saying, I committed this crime with this blonde friend who had wire rimmed glasses. And actually, Cottrell says, I see this man at two points in time. I have interactions with this blonde man. And the question being whether he's created this person or the confession entirely, or whether this actually is this person who, you know, people at the church identified a person with blonde hair and glasses. And of course, there were the glasses found at the crime scene.
But that was before the Unsolved Mysteries. So he couldn't have gotten the glasses from the Unsolved Mysteries.
Correct.
Correct. He would have had to have read that in the newspaper, like the other detail that he may well have pulled up from the newspaper.
Yeah, and that's, for me, it sort of starts to add up a bit. I mean, I don't think it's anything certain, but the state's theory essentially is that this is something that's made up by Cottrell, or at least he's embellishing. And yeah, they can point to different things in the media to say, you know, there's a person who was shot at and they fainted and the shooter might have thought that they shot them. And there's a person with blonde hair and glasses who's identified by the people in the church. But, you know, you're starting to get to the point where this individual, Jeff Cottrell, is having to combine a lot of pieces of information out there into this comprehensible confession that Barentine gave. And, you know, at some point, you just have to think, you know, could really somebody be consistent enough and find all these details in the press and combine it into this story? And, you know, maybe, but I think there's some reason to believe what he's saying here.
So the difference is the accomplice at this point. And Donnie Barentine does superficially resemble the composite. That's correct?
Yeah, except for the fact that his hair is darker. And so there was this statement, I think, in the episode where they said, you know, we can rule out Barentine because he doesn't have blonde hair. But if you sort of take his picture and darken the hair, then actually he looks a good deal like the shooter involved in the case. And so.
Mm-hmm. And remember, Cora Fisher thought the hair was darker. Her composite had a much darker hair.
Yeah, not so everybody is saying, yeah, that it's blonde hair.
She had a good look at the shooter, right? Cora Fisher?
She says that, yeah. We have, you know, we raised the questions in the episode about the veracity of Cora Fisher's statements. But according to her, she had a great look at the shooter.
Squarespace is encouraging folks to make it. Make it yourself. Easily create a website by yourself. Make it stand out. Stand out with a beautiful website. Do you want to create a fan website about unsolved mysteries? Do you want to create a website about the Dixie Mafia? Do you have a true crime case that you always wanted to write about but never had the form? Squarespace has you covered. Things you can create with Squarespace. You can create a beautiful website to turn your cool idea into a new website. Showcase your work. Blog or publish content. Sell products and services of all kinds. Promote your physical or online business. Announce an upcoming event or special project. Squarespace does this by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. Everything optimized for mobile right out of the box. a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, analytics that help you grow in real time, built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. Squarespace is used by architects, makeup artists, sports teams, and interior designers, and now it can be used by you. Head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
And of course, the big sort of bombshell. Now I'm very careful about using bombshells, Colin. I'm very sensitive about the subject. But the other big thing was some of the Unsolved Mysteries tips seemed to indicate that there was a mafia connection that possibly indicated that the preacher at Rising Daughter may well have been the target because of something the preacher's son was supposedly involved in. But do we have any information on whether the actual pastor at Rising Daughter even had a son?
I'm not aware of that. It's possible that Susan has uncovered something related to that, but at least at this point, I'm not aware of anything with the pastor. So I'm not aware of him not having a son, but I'm not aware of specific information that he does or did.
A couple other people mentioned that it was the wrong church and the wrong people, too. So, like, you know, that's another consideration. Maybe it was the wrong church and the wrong people, and not just the wrong people at the church, if it was a mafia connection.
Yes, then it could have been any of the local churches. You would have to find if the pastor just happened to have a son who was in the witness relocation program. Of course, if they were in the witness relocation program, we wouldn't know because they're in the witness relocation program. So that's a particularly hard one to research, I would imagine. Susan, I'm sure, has some facility. I'm sure she'll figure it out. Another, and I won't call it a bombshell, another thing that was a big possibility was the possibility of Donnie's jailhouse confession. Colin, where on earth would they keep records of something like that? That's what I think we have a few questions on social media of people saying there must have been some record of something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think so. I mean, that would be something where the person in the jailhouse who heard the confession would then speak with correctional officers at the jail and likely eventually the police and prosecutors. And you would think, of course, this being a confession and important, there would be a record somewhere of this confession taking place. But we don't know where it is at this point and if we'll ever see it.
Another records question is, if Jeff Cottrell is saying that at one point he did own the duster, and of course his story was changing about that, wouldn't there have been a registration or a record of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's where if Susan hasn't tracked that down yet, certainly a private investigator or someone should be able to access the records to see what vehicle was connected to Jeff Cottrell at the relevant period in time. And certainly his own statements make it seem like he did have this in 1985. But yeah, I'm not sure how far along we are on that confirmation at this point.
And it occurred to me, the machine gun that was found in Donnie Barentine's car, or I don't know if he actually owned the car, but in the car with Donnie Barentine, did they ever figure out the provenance of that, where that came from?
No, as far as I know, that was, you know, they had the machine gun, but we don't know where he accessed that, what his supplier was, or anything connected to it beyond the existence of it.
Again, to me, that just reeks of some sort of deal was made, you know, either for information or something, because they just dropped that. Obviously, he went to jail for that. That was the federal charge against him was just for the machine gun, correct?
Correct, yeah.
And yeah. So obviously he was charged for that, but that they never seemed to have pressured where somebody would just happen to find something like that. And with the roll of tape and the pantyhose, this was clearly they were on the way to some sort of, you know, they were going to, you know, pressure somebody or threaten to kill somebody to get paid. So many things are red flags in that particular situation. I would be very surprised if that was not a product of deal making by the prosecutors. Now, we know Donnie is still alive. Has he committed any crimes since then, or at least been prosecuted for any crimes?
I mean, I do not know his subsequent criminal history. I'm not aware at the moment of whether he had a subsequent record.
Oh, I wanted to bring up, it has just been announced that Sarah Koenig is doing another series of Serial, which everybody's excited about. I'm certainly excited about. I was one of the few people who was a huge fan of season 2 as well. I'm not a hater. But a lot of us are excited because it's about she's delving deeply into the Cleveland court system. And I mean, Celeste, that must be interesting to you.
I love this approach for the season of Serial. I've been to Cleveland. It's one of those cities where you have, you know, the most incredible wealth and the most destitute of situations of poverty. And so I think it's a really great city to use for this new model of podcast that they're doing. But I also think, you know, looking at individual cases, as much as I love doing this and helping to tell the stories of individuals and their families, I think it's hard for some people to look at this and think, oh, well, this is a systemic issue. I think a lot of people think, oh, well, these are one-off cases. It's, you know, here and there, and this doesn't really happen all the time. And the system is not designed to fail people. It just once in a while makes a mistake. And so I think that looking at the whole entire system of that city on more of a macro level is going to be really helpful for some people who might not necessarily realize that, you know, not just wrongful convictions, but over sentencing and overcharging and things like that. It really is a problem. And it's not just about wrongful convictions, but it's nice to look at more of a macro level approach this way so that people who look at things, you know, some people look at individuals and think, okay, that is what is really going to change my mind. Some people look at policy. Some people look at more of a macro level idea and statistics and things like that. So I'm really excited to see what they come up with. And I can't wait for the season to start.
I was amazed just at listening to the trailer at the access. I mean, she was listening in on attorneys talking to their clients. I mean, obviously not giving up privilege material, but clearly most courthouses are not very open to journalists. And I was really surprised at that.
Right. It's going to be an amazing season. The amount of access it seems like they've given her is going to be incredibly eye-opening for a lot of people, I think.
I hope so. Colin, would that create, I mean, as I said, it sounded like she was overhearing actual conversations between attorneys and clients. And I thought, oh, okay. Well, I mean, they're in an open courtroom. Does that make it not privileged?
Yes, the attorney-client privilege, it covers confidential communications between a client and their attorney and vice versa. And so that's the question. I mean, most times if you're in open court and you're speaking with your clients, then there would be no assumption of confidentiality. The question would be, I'm not sure exactly what she was recording. I guess there potentially could be situations where the attorney and the client thought they were speaking in hushed tones and they were sort of apart from other people, and yet the recording equipment for Serial was picking it up. And so that could potentially create some issues down the road. But I mean, my entry into this whole podcast in this realm was the first season and blogging about the issues of the case. And I think this is a great opportunity here to educate the public on so many of these issues that are infecting the criminal justice system.
So Colin sent me this note that earlier this week, the National Registry of Exonerations reported a landmark. There are 2,265 exonerees who have served more than 20,000 years for crimes that they did not commit. And this has resulted in states paying more than $2.2 billion in compensation for these exonerees, with the amounts differing by state and by race, with African-American defendants receiving less compensation on average than their Caucasian counterparts. First of all, these are astounding statistics. Even that $2.2 billion is just in compensation. We're not talking about the expense of trying these people and incarcerating these people for all these decades. It's a huge expense. One question I wanted to direct to you, Celeste. Have any of the people that you've worked with actually been able to get compensation?
Pennsylvania doesn't have compensation legislation on the books right now. So basically, if you're exonerated, the state's like, okay, thanks for serving your time. Not really even an apology, but go ahead and move on. There's no compensation built into that. So especially with Pennsylvania, with a history that we have as far as injustices and wrongful convictions and exonerations, the fact that we don't have a compensation statute on the books is really, really concerning. So basically, if you're exonerated in Pennsylvania, you have to sue the jurisdiction in which you were convicted. You can sue the police, you can sue the city. And so what my good friend Tony Wright, who was exonerated by the Innocence Project in New York, he's been home just about 2 years. So he was just awarded the largest settlement in Philadelphia history. He was just awarded $9.85 million after serving 25 years while he was exonerated. And he was exonerated after 25 years. He was exonerated by DNA. And they actually just did file a lawsuit, I believe, against the prosecutor for misconduct. She knew that he had not been guilty, and I believe a few of the police officers did too. So yeah, Tony Wright, he just after 25 years, he did get $9.85 million, but he had to go through the process of suing the city to get that. And that took 2 years. And so for most people, after you're exonerated, you don't have anything. I mean, you were in prison for this many years. And so what really do you have? You know, a friend of mine was recently released, and he's innocent, and he is having a hard time, really, really struggling, because he was not compensated by Pennsylvania. So, you know, it really is. It's a frustrating situation, because we do have so many citizens returning who were innocent and were prosecuted wrongfully in Pennsylvania. But there's nothing that the state is doing to fix that or to compensate them for their time and for the mistakes.
So when a prisoner is released who's been exonerated, there's no mechanism whatsoever that they basically have to file for welfare? Is that what they're left with?
Basically, you know, you can go and get a job and support yourself. Nothing built in from the state to help you as far as compensating you for the time that you've spent. So you can apply for public assistance and things like that to help you get on your feet, but it's certainly nothing that is going to help you live the life that you deserve to live after that long of being wrongfully incarcerated.
And we know that it's super easy for people to get jobs straight out of prison.
Yeah, it's great.
It's a walk in the park.
Philadelphia recently has been awesome at building a network of resources for returning citizens, not just the exonerated and the innocent, but returning citizens. We have a lot of juvenile lifers coming home, which is fantastic. And so Philadelphia has been great at making resources available for those returning citizens. There's so much more work to do, but I have to say, I'm kind of proud of some organizations in Philadelphia for trying to help, because they know they have nothing and they're just sent home, you know? So it's been great to watch.
Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to your door. Like me, are you stressed by the end of summer and the start of the school year? Let Blue Apron do the meal prep for you, making back to school easier than ever. With Blue Apron, you can have dinner in as little as 20 minutes. They have quick and easy recipe options with insanely delicious flavors. And they have perfectly portioned ingredients delivered right to your door. So you can skip meal planning and shopping and get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. Plus, they have chef-designed recipes and exciting September partnerships like Bob's Burgers Inspired and Whole30 Approved. Now, as you know, I'm a big fan of Blue Apron, and my wife and I have taken to getting the four-person meals on Fridays and sharing them with friends. So a week from now, we're getting the crispy spiced fish and caper mayo with brown rice, tomatoes, and zucchini. And we'll share that with two of our friends. And then a week from then, we'll get the creamy tomato shrimp and orzo with kale, zucchini, and basil pesto and share that with two other friends. And now you too can try Blue Apron. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I wanted to get to some listener questions, actually. We got one from Sheila Berry, who says, I just watched the original Unsolved Mysteries episode. What's this about an identical sketch from Kansas? Could this guy be the white whale that the Perry defense was looking for? A transient who committed the crime with Barentine, then moved away from Georgia/Florida area? Colin?
Yeah, so this is a question I've been waiting for since we started this series. Of course, if you watch the Unsolved Mysteries episode, you'll see that there is this identical sketch of someone from Kansas. And there's this question of, well, could this person be the shooter in the Swain case? And that is certainly something that I can't discuss now, but in deeper into this series a bit, we'll discuss the Kansas sketch in more detail.
Okay, that's just tantalizing. We also got one from Josh May, who says the dimmable lenses were also very unlikely to be worn while welding, as the welding mask is already dimmed or has an auto dim function and would not be able to see what you were doing welding/wearing that type of glasses. So the idea that Josh is trying to make that I'm destroying, unfortunately, is that those glasses that were pitted as though somebody who wore them was welding, you wouldn't actually wear with a welder's mask, because a welder's mask actually dims the light. That's obviously the point of a welder's mask. Is it possible that you would like go commando style and, you know, use the mask for a minute and then flip it up and use your glasses for a second? I'm innocent of welding. I was not in Flashdance. I am not Jennifer Beals. We had another question along those lines from Hallie Kate. First of all, she says, John Cryer, I missed you on last week's addendum, although it was still good. You know, God bless you. to me, the two-tone welder's hair does not make sense. The mask that caused the hair would have kept slag marks off of his glasses. I don't suppose Barentine ever remembered his blonde co-partier's friend's name. Oh, that's a second question. Yeah, her point is that the mask would have kept the slag marks off the glasses. So it's a similar question to that. Whatever it is, the glasses being used by a welder may not make sense, it sounds like. But her other question was, I don't suppose Barentine ever remembered this blonde co-partier friend's name. I'm sure Donnie was asked, who did you take to that party?
He probably was. I'm not sure if we have an answer. We can check on that and follow up on the next addendum.
Yeah, there was one part, a snippet of an interview that I couldn't tell who was speaking. And I thought, oh, is that Donnie? The guy who, and I think it was in the previous episode, episode 10, which would be 9, John, because math. in episode 9, there was an interview snippet, and I couldn't tell who was talking because it was Susan saying, oh, would it surprise you that you were a suspect in this? And the person replying was like, well, it would surprise me. But then it sort of alluded to that was Donnie. But Donnie wouldn't have been surprised because he'd been questioned over and over for 30 years. So I'm confused. I'm confused, Colin. Nothing new here. I'm confused.
I remember that interview. I remember what interview you're talking about. And I honestly, I don't remember who it was either. And I had the same question. Wait, who is this? So I can't be of help.
Thanks, Celeste. Way to go.
Well, it could be a man named Larry Linker, if I'm looking at the correct clip.
Ah, could be. Could be. Okay, we got one from @JNW who says, can you clarify what tests they used to confirm hairs on glasses did or did not match? I thought hair analysis was outed as junk science.
Yeah, so you might recall there was this report in the Washington Post a couple of years ago now saying that 95% of these hair identifications were incorrect and often led to false convictions. And what that was just microscopic examination, not DNA. So just sort of under the microscope, looking at the suspect hair and then the hair taken from the person of interest and making a visual comparison between the two. And, you know, unsurprisingly, this is a procedure that's not very reliable and led to a lot of wrongful convictions. What was done here was the mitochondrial DNA testing to determine whether the DNA on the hair matched with Dennis Perry's DNA, which is thought to be much more reliable than just the microscopic examination.
And there's different levels of mitochondrial DNA testing, correct?
Correct. And then there's a question of exactly how much of the hair you have. Do you have the follicle? Do you have the root? And so, right, there's definitely different degrees of reliability based upon the type of testing done and how much of the hair was there to test.
We got another very sort of enigmatic, but I think meaningful question, which is from @LanceLovett, who says Plymouth Duster equals Dodge Dart. I think he was pointing out that there were many auto companies that would rebrand different cars that they made just with different brand names, and that the Plymouth Duster was in fact the equivalent of the Dodge Dart, and that might be leading to some of the confusion here.
Yeah, I mean, if that's correct.
Yes, I hope that's yes. If Lance Lovett is to be believed, thank you, Lance, for giving us that little factoid. We much appreciate it. We also got one from @LoveChubRub. Who says, I'm curious about the anonymous tip that said it wasn't Donnie, but someone who looked like him. Could it have been Jane Beaver trying to steer authorities away? Any connection between Jane Beaver and Donnie B? So that's an interesting idea, the idea that Jane Beaver might have called in an incorrect tip to Unsolved Mysteries. Obviously, we have no evidence of that, I can imagine. But I like how you think, Love Chub Rub. you're thinking on many levels. Much appreciated. Do we have any record of any kind of connection between Jane and Donnie Barentine?
No, I'm not aware of any relationship or connection between Jane Beaver and Donnie Barentine.
Got it. The idea would be that Jane was trying to throw somebody off as a favor to Donnie for some reason. Obviously, we have no information to confirm or deny that. Okay, we got one from @TSamanthaB, who's just wondering if Joey Watkins, Curtis Flowers, Pamela Neer, Ronnie Long, Jamar Huggins, Adnan Syed, and Dennis Perry are out of jail yet. And then she adds, I mean, come on, which we all agree. Samantha, it's ridiculous and sad, but none of them are out of jail. at this point.
And Ronnie Long has a birthday this week. So if you get a chance and you're on Twitter, send him a birthday message. And I know his wife will go visit him this week and she'll give him the birthday messages.
That would be great. Thank you, Samantha. We also got one from at Celia Barlow 1, who says, wrongful conviction overturned in Oregon based solely on testimony and no physical evidence. Appreciate a shout out to Mr. Wax and the OIP on the addendum. That's the, I believe, the Oregon Innocence Project. Yes, I saw that case. That was a gentleman who was in jail for about 18 months on evidence that even the prosecutor eventually said this was just there was not enough. And he apologized. So, yes, absolutely. Shout out to Oregon Innocence Project. Way to go, guys.
Good work.
Yes. Just chipping away.
Lucy the Labrador, which was the person claiming this crime, said that the defendant had shot and killed her dog. And it was the discovery of this dog, Lucy the Labrador, still alive, that led to this conviction being thrown out.
Oh, shades of Joey Watkins. Yeah, it's remarkable how animal cruelty plays into, you know, a jury decision, even though it doesn't technically have anything to do with the actual crime that was alleged. We got one last one from Kathy Cohen Vollen, who says, Dear Undisclosed, a couple of weeks ago, my local NPR station had a short positive piece about the effectiveness of giving out unsolved cases playing cards in prison. I couldn't believe they were doing this. Listening to Undisclosed leads me to believe that all these cards are doing are prompting unreliable jailhouse snitches to give false information. Could you get the Undisclosed team to weigh in on the reliability of these cards on an addendum? We're about to do that, Kathy. Colin, how do you feel about that?
I haven't actually seen the card, so I can't comment too much, but it's certainly something that could taint a conviction easily. I mean, jailhouse snitches are notorious for being given information by the police and using that to claim a false confession by their jailhouse person they share a cell with. And if they're giving out these cards and they have information about cases, you can easily see how this would get the ball rolling on a wrongful conviction.
As Colin said, this is I can't see this being anything but problematic. Jailhouse snitches, we know, are such a problematic issue with wrongful convictions. And also, you know, using those things to try to get deals on your own cases and things like that. And it just seems there's a better use of time and a much better way of trying to solve cases than using this method. I mean,
yeah, it's interesting that the press coverage was good, but I imagine that happens all the time. You've got journalists who cover that beat trying to get close to law enforcement, and law enforcement has messages they want to get out. And that, I'm sure, was one of them. But one would hope that journalists could cast a more critical eye on it.
Yeah, and the follow-up, I'm sure, will be at some point in the next couple of years, we're going to hear about a case where someone got one of these cards and implicated someone who, you know, we'll see. I'll have to do some more research on this to see exactly how problematic this is.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the impulse for law enforcement. Obviously, they're just trying to, you know, find some way to dredge up some new information. I'm sure it's in good faith in general, but it will cause more problems than it solves. And we've seen that in the past. Okay, I wanted to mention that Undisclosed has actually taken a couple of weeks off. There's going to be a couple of bonus episodes that Colin is putting together. And Colin, could you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, so next week I have two special episodes coming out. There are two things I'm working on. One, as some of you might have seen on Twitter, there's this man, Charles Rhines. He's a homosexual man who committed a murder in South Dakota and was given the death penalty. And jurors after the fact said, we gave him the death penalty because he, as a gay man, we thought he would enjoy prison and therefore didn't want to give him a life sentence. Generally, jurors are not allowed to impeach their verdict by saying they engaged in misconduct during deliberations. If there's juror racial bias, you can have impeachment. The courts in South Dakota are saying that does not extend to anti-gay bias by jurors. And so that's one special episode. The second is that South Carolina is one of five states that does not have hate crimes laws. And so I'm partnering with a representative here in South Carolina to try to get a hate crimes bill passed. Interestingly, Georgia, the site of the Swain slayings, which were possibly hate crimes, is one of the other five states that does not have a hate crimes law. And so they have legislation there they're trying to pass. So the episode is going to deal with the history, the purpose, and the mechanics of hate crime statutes.
Well, I am looking forward. Well, thank you, Colin. And thank you, Celeste. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much. Hey, can I real quick plug an event for FAM for my new job?
Plug away.
All right. I have to. So it's actually a really neat. FAM's teaming up with HBO to host several screenings across the country of The Sentence, which is a Sundance Award-winning documentary that captures a family's experience with federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws. And it's a really, really powerful movie. And it should be eye-opening for people who aren't really aware of this issue. But there's a couple screenings across the state, September 19th at Arizona State University, the law school there in Phoenix, September 24th at Stetson Law School in Gulfport, Florida, September 25th at Temple Law School in Philadelphia, which I will be there. So come out and see me if you are from Philadelphia. And then September 29th at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee. And then we have a couple events in Pittsburgh, California, and Maryland, some other places. If you're interested, you can go to fam.org and then click on Become an Advocate. And there's all kinds of information about these screenings. It should be a really, really great series of events. So if you are in those areas, please consider coming out.
Yes, I heard about that film. I've heard it's really, really terrific.
It's going to be incredible. So you should definitely try to catch it if you can.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Celeste. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Please give my best to all the fellas that you talk to on the regular. And thank you, Colin, once again. Please be safe, be careful, batten down the hatches, and we will talk again soon. And that's it for another addendum. I want to remind everybody, Undisclosed has a Patreon. It is at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And when you sign up for that Patreon, you will get those special bonus episodes with Rabia, Colin, and Susan. Not with me yet. Maybe if you really complain a lot, they'll include me on them. But I do want to assure everybody, I'm not getting a dime from the Patreon. The Patreon's going straight to the investigative work that Undisclosed does. I do want to let you know we will be taking a little break with the addenda for a while. There's going to be some bonus episodes that Colin's going to do. And we will be coming back after the Undisclosed team takes a little bit of a hiatus. If you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. There's a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. I am donating all my fees, as I said, to the Georgia Innocence Project this season. You can find them on the web at georgiainnocenceproject.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, once again. He's just lovely. As well as Hannah McCarthy, who does our audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, who is our project manager. And thank you all for listening once again. It's such a pleasure to work for you guys, and I will be back as soon as I can.